Hi, my name is Nela Milic, the curator of the Balkanizing Taxonomy Research Project, part of my PhD in visual sociology. The project consists of a textiles and photography exhibition, a website which serves as an information and networking portal, and a symposium that took place on the 15th of November 2008 at Goldsmiths, University of London. In this podcast, we hear from Jasmina Cibic, a participant of the symposium who presents a paper, Tourists Welcome, or How the Myth Loses Its Grounds.
Shortly after 1989, a dramatic shift in the artistic perception of the historical avant-garde in Eastern Europe can be observed. This shift was caused by the changing relationship to the notion of utopia, both in its political and its artistic connotation. Where before the reception of the historic avant-garde connected with a political utopia and was critiqued and rejected through artistic actions, in the 1990s, with a new generation of artists, all totalitarian connotations are lost, and new readings and artistic receptions of the historical avant-garde become not only possible, but favorable. The new generation of artists is lacking a utopian past, now, even if only in terms of a fake memory or a fake authenticity, which basically sets out completely different demands for political mobilization. In the 1980s and the 1990s, we are actually facing two chronologically successive stances of diverse artistic strategies. We basically have the retro-avant-garde of the 1980s with NSK, Irvin, Malevich from Belgrade, and retro-utopianism of the 1990s with Marko Pilhan, Vadim Fishkin, etc. Now, the retro-avant-garde's tactics are those of subversive affirmation and over-identification. These are forms of critique which put the spectator, viewer, through an aesthetic experience via identification. They stage or create a bodily experience of what is being criticized. These tactics do not rely on an imposition of an authoritative narrative, but on methods of imitation, simulation, mimicry, and camouflage, where they disappear into the background and allow the artist to take part in the existing ideological, political, or economic discourse and affirm or consume it whilst contemporarily critiquing it. In the early 1980s, the fine art group Irvin, music group Laibach, and the theater CC Nordung, and the design group New Collectivism formed one of the most powerful collectives from the east of Europe, NSK, Neue Slowenische Kunst, or New Slovene Art. And this was basically the NSK state in time, where you basically see the diagram of the whole functioning of all the organizations. The NSK state in time was established as a virtual state without a real territory and functioned as a transposition as much as it was also a spectralization of the evacuation of specific historical, social, political spaces of Eastern Europe. The NSK state, however, did materialize in real space on certain occasions, which was basically opening of its embassies and consulates in private apartments, houses, and hotels, where the choice of location was also an institutional critique of the non-existing Eastern European art market. The actions of NSK artists resulted in a formation of a parallel system of bureaucratical apparatus of state and its inherent artifacts production. So these are basically passports, insignia, etc. NSK equipolated symbolically charged motifs from Malevich's cross to the Nazi swastika, where an appropriation of components and elements of the ruling ideology was made. The true power of NSK does not lay in an imposition of an authoritative narrative, but in setting up an encounter between art and society, between the real and the artificially constructed. We are presented with an actual stage where a movement of simulacra, which is offered as material for audiences' identification, does not stand in opposition to the authentic movement characteristic of communal bodies. This is a quote from Rancière. An organism of NSK was put forward as even more total than totalitarianism itself. In 1987, the new collectivism, so basically the design part of NSK, won the public tender for the design of the poster and baton for the Youth Day celebrations, which was basically the 25th of May, where in Yugoslavia there was for Tito's birthday and the National Youth Day, a celebration where pioneers were running across the state, handing to each other this baton. The jury of art experts and politicians was unaware that they have selected a redesign of a painting done by Richard Klein, a German artist of the Third Reich. In the re-elaboration by new collectivism, the Nazi flag was replaced by the Yugoslav, the German eagle with a white dove, and the background image was replaced with the image of the Slovene national symbol, the mountain Triglav. The problems began when the selected poster was printed in Politika, Belgrade daily newspaper, and later noticed by some mechanical engineer who made the connection to Klein's painting. Yugoslav media was alerted, and virtually overnight the poster scandal erupted. In the documentary Laibach, a film from Slovenia, the closing chapter shows a performance of the Laibach music group somewhere in America, where a member of the audience is asked if he enjoyed the concert. He basically says yes, and the answer to this yes is because they made me feel pride to be a member of a country I don't belong to. So both these quoted cases speak precisely of this transposition of authority of state to the authority of the aesthetic experience. And it is only through the audience's involvement that the artistic intention of critique comes to life. NSK managed to create an absolute totality, a hyper-literal repetition of the totalitarian ritual. Now, the key notion in the case of subversive affirmation is to repeat the aesthetic condition of the totalitarian aesthetic, and with it, the erasure of any outside viewpoint of the spectator, reader, listener. Now, retro-utopianism, so basically now we're on to the 1990s, comes about with a shift within the artistic reception of the historical avant-garde's utopia project. Political implications are lost and in a dedicated research into what Agamben calls past potential futures starts. Now, the new generation of artists is interested in the past that loved the future, a sort of withdrawal of all potentially totalitarian tendencies where the discourse archaeology of the retro-avant-garde is substituted by a media archaeology. Retro-utopianism repeats the past, now in this case the historical avant-garde's early utopian fantasies of technology, but with a pre-catastrophic view. So this is basically disregarding the totalitarian utopia project and returning to the pre-modern state and the unrealized scientific and artistic fantasies of the earlier 20th century. But when the Eastern European artists make the detour from the actual future and its political implications to the upheaval of these past potential futures, technological dreams from the beginning of the 20th century, such as those of Nikola Tesla or Buchmeister Fuller, as we see with Puttrich, they're actually following the official ideology's reformatting and erasure of recent historical events and its political past. That is why retro-utopianism is not actually nostalgic per se, but quite on the contrary, it is very well aware of the state of affairs and presents a politically mobilized condition with its reaction to the temporal and spatial factuality, because it chooses not to illustrate, depict, what had by now become a stance of ethnic chic in Eastern Europe, so the failed political exotic of a certain political order. It shifts away from the trauma of the recent historical events. Now, this is a similar condition art practices have actually encountered in Western Europe in the 1950s. Now, the upheaval of retro-utopianism is also rooted in the persisting problematic of the export of artworks and the impossibility of the export of their original context. Marina Gorzinic, this is from a text which was published in a catalog, Strangers to Ourselves. She basically argues that the result of this technology of transfer is that works of art coming from the third and second worlds are removed from the source of their primary conceptual inner contextual value and are redesigned and freed from the specific cultural contexts. Now, she calls such works of art cultural reactors and their only purpose to show the existence of the mechanisms of transportation by the Western art market. Retro-utopianism also proposes a paradigm of a system where an artist is able to reflect essential dimensions and contradictions of the real, existing system without entering directly into the social, political, or anthropological analysis, or without abandoning a highly personal language or approach. Vadim Fishkin is perhaps the most interesting representative of retro-utopianism, as well as a logical successor of the retro-avant-garde. His work still bears a strong relationship with authority, but this authority is now completely lacking power. So the common denominator of Fishkin's project is basically to show us, the spectator, how in the contemporary condition nobody believes what Lacan names the big other. We know very well by now that there is no master in charge and that the agencies in power are nothing but artificial creations. Fishkin deliberately plays with the fact that we are all pretending to have a belief in authority. His projects transfer this onto the artist-spectator dialogue, where the aesthetic experience reveals radical falsity and failure. As spectators, we do not ask ourselves of belief, disbelief, but realize in the same instance as we step into the gallery, the fiction behind the proposed symbolic order. Choose Your Day is a performative installation where a comfortable armchair is placed in a room without natural light. Next to the armchair, there is an electronic display with the following buttons describing different conditions on Mars: sunny day, sunset, rainy day, winter evening, full moon night, and stormy night. When the visitor presses one of the buttons, the corresponding environment appears in the room. There is a projection of a window, and the appropriate lighting and sound appear. We know very well that the experience proposed to us as a viewer is false, and that in reality the weather conditions on Mars are far different from the ones we experience within the proposed installation. But the shift from the retro-avant-garde's proposed aesthetic experience is that with the latter, we are not submitted to an authoritative narrative. Fishkin's projects, on the other hand, submit the viewer precisely to this authoritative narrative, but simultaneously reveal its failure. Now, in Lacan's terms, one of the keys of sustaining one's symbolic universe is the existence of the a propos lacking desideratum, the object cause of desire. We can go further with the claim of the necessity of it remaining a lack, for as Lacan shows us, as soon as the subject is close to its achievement, the focus of desire shifts to a new object. The argument is followed by what the other sees in me as this hidden treasure, which is why I am desired in the first place. The problem arises when this hidden treasure shifts ground or disappears, as in our case with the totalitarianism of Eastern European countries. And I am recognized precisely for this vanishing, and the lack is substituted for loss. The new generation of Eastern European artists in the contemporary condition, finally, in contrast to the retro-utopianism of the 1990s, recognizes the lost myth, the desideratum deposed to the onlooker, the West. So the discourse archaeology has returned with a new generation of artists, but the key difference to the 1980s retro-avant-garde is the totality they are working within. So, and what they are actually affirming with their reappropriation of retro-avant-garde's tactics, and the fact they are not only aware of the inner contextual value of their work, but also already expect and plan the artwork's transportation into the different contexts. If we look at the new generation of artists from former Eastern Europe, we can denote a formulation of strategic behavior, which posits the artist as the myth maker who creates an itinerary for the onlooker. Now, the onlooker, the spectator, has basically shifted from a pilgrim within a modern paradigm into a vagabond, destroyer, voyager, tourist, if you want. Now, the artist in this case takes into the account the fictional client, so the imaginary viewer, the futurist whose gaze will animate the artwork eventually. But the myth that Eastern Europe had inherent within itself has long ago disappeared. So it seems a very vital question now that we ask ourselves which myth is now being constructed and put forward. Now, Martin Britzel-Zevarlandia answers this question straightforwardly. There is no existing myth. It is still lacking, but its vacant position is left to the spectator to invent and impose. Britzel proposes a fictional travel agency where the visitor-spectator himself decides what his ideal travel destination will appear like. Travel agents lead the potential client to a computer which generated a postcard image through a technique of collage of the available imagery. Everlandia also, of course, comes with appropriate souvenirs from bottled water, mugs, and refrigerator magnets. Everlandia is also an answer to the global capitalism's focus on portraying the former East as an instance similar to that of a tourist attraction. Bon Voyage is an interactive performance which was staged by the art collective Passaporte in 2005. The action was carried out in a place and in a time that are transitional par excellence, on board a train whilst crossing a state border between Slovenia and Italy. At the moment of crossing the border, the Passaporte artists, dressed in self-designated and designed uniforms, mimic a third bureaucracy. They form a fictional insertion between the moments of the two official border controls. Passaporte distributes between the passengers free travel equipment that includes toothpaste, toothbrush, soap, and shampoo, sanitary products which are a strictly necessary thing for any traveler coming from the Western democracy. Its signifier depends on the train's destination point, however. A hygiene kit is distributed either upon entering the West and on the train's return. the East of Europe. Now, the subtitle to this performance was We Give You a Free Pass to Enter the Desired Destination. And this is basically an invitation to accept a gift, to visit the elsewhere where the never-seen places find space in the memory and the imagination of the passengers. Now, to the contrary to Everlandia, Bon Voyage is an event which takes place outside of the sphere of art. There are no art spectators present on board the train, nor is the event advertised. The figures of the spectator and of the passenger furthermore seek to conciliate themselves, what inevitably causes the confusion of the artistic reception of the project. Who is namely the public and what is being offered? Everlandia presents itself within an art gallery and furthermore shows the empty banality of the chosen desired destination. Printed on a postcard, the art spectator takes home. It all along stays well inside the artistic sphere, and that is why it lacks critical engagement. It only repeats the mechanisms of travel industry, but when it transfers them from the sphere of life into the recognizable realm of fiction, it exposes the radical falsity of its project. It reveals itself as just another instance of critical distance. Bon Voyage, on the other hand, poses as a parasitic action where there is only a trajectory but no depiction of its destination, no image proposed. Passaporta's subversive identification lies precisely within affirming the official culture's rebranding of Eastern European countries, which are only offering empty slogans, tourist services, and ensuite minibars. Passaporta comes close to the ultimate over-identification, which would ultimately refuse to be labeled as art. It is for sure also the most risky and potentially dangerous tactic, as it can easily be misunderstood. In this constellation, it is the recipient to whom full responsibility is being transferred. At the same time, if well conceived, this tactic is ultimately also the most intensive for the viewer. Agamben argues in his Infancy and History that the necessary correlation of experience lies not in knowledge but in authority, and within the contemporary condition it is all too clear to us that no agency has sufficient authority to guarantee the truth of experience. All authority is in fact based on what, apropos, cannot be experienced. And this is what the new artistic strategies add up to. The myth, or to put it more eloquently, its lact, is never disclosed. And this is precisely a tactic of subversive affirmation, where the current totality of the global market receives a reply in its own fantasy image simply. And this construction follows Rancière's description of a suitable political work. The ideal effects he calls upon are a negotiation between the readability of the message that threatens to destroy the sensible form of art and the radical uncanniness that threatens to destroy all political meaning. I really wanted to maybe look at and examine the current situation in basically the general approach to doing art, especially in Slovenia. Because we basically had only one institution, which was the Modern Gallery, that forwarded a mono discourse basically since the 50s, which was the reappropriation of modernism, which is funnily enough now happening on both fields, the East and the West, especially in sculpture. So if we look at this, but more from a kind of social standpoint as well, we already start to see there the differences of how modernism was already different for the East and West and the perception of the avant-garde. So basically, I kind of wanted to look at these strategies and how they actually come to today's standpoint, where we have very similar tendencies in art in the East and in the West, and how they basically come up with this idea, from this idea of how they deal with authority. And so basically how they deal with the other, but the other in this case being the spectator, or, you know, in the case of Eastern Europe, always the art market of the West, because the East never had it. So whether the technique of, for example, subversive affirmation appears having a totalitarian tendency of a state in mind, or a totalitarian tendency of the market, is basically the same thing. So I just try to look at how maybe artists now cope with these two different totalities, which maybe one generated at the beginning the strategy, but then through time this strategy just kind of reformed itself to be now dealing with the totality of the market. There's an amazing, actually, paraphrased by Miwon Kwan, I think, in I forgot the title of her book, but it's about actually a person sitting on a plane going to the same place as the place he was supposed to go to. And she was basically saying if he would be an artist, this would be a perfect example of a critique of site specificity. But in terms of my project and kind of these insertions, because I tend to actually insert these projects within existing bureaucracies, within existing very rigid state-organized instances. But what I'm actually interested in is maybe kind of small shifts in the normal functioning of a space. Because I find that it's easy to, if you get back to your thing with the permissions, for example, with the flags, once you get the permission to do something, because also, for example, the Passaporta performances, we had all the paperwork. So none of these projects are guerrilla tactics or ad hoc. They're all, you know, allowed by the instance, by the, you know, government, whatever. But it's much more interesting to actually just finally subvert the system so you actually insert an action within it that might be almost expected, which is, you know, the case of your flags, instead of, you know, just kind of really, you know, doing something very loud and, you know, making it obvious it's an artwork. Because then you kind of, you know, you can really then ask yourself whether, you know, well, it's, if you make something too obvious, it's not necessarily even, you know, it doesn't shift anything. It just, it's too loud. It's just, you know, people do not maybe start to think about, you know, the created situation, but it's more like a hoax, if you want. But just to get back to your flags, for example, there was just a project at the Modern Gallery in Ljubljana, the museum on the street, which was basically only artworks which were outside of the museum. And actually, NSK wanted to do a project. They wanted to hang a flag on the flagpole of the Ljubljana castle, which is on the top of the hill, very visible, and they didn't get the permission. And I just thought when you were talking about the flags, it's quite amazing because NSK are very well known. They have made projects with the Albanian army, I think even with the Croatian army, with a lot of armies which were basically wearing their insignias, their flags. They couldn't do it with the Slovenian army. Yeah, they couldn't hang the flag on top of the castle. So it's, you know, when you actually then looking at, you know, especially art practices which deal with this sort of issues, and when it comes to their, you know, point of departure, usually there you've got problems. As soon as you export yourself, it's like, oh yeah, you know, it's work about nationalism, but it's not about our nationalism. Mm-hmm. Every spectator can have their own reading of the thing. And for example, the train project, it was amazing how different nationalities reacted to the action. For example, the Spanish were giving us their real passports. The Italian bureaucracy thought we were the Slovenian police officers with new uniforms, because apparently Slovenians did change them so many times. So it was actually the most amazing thing was this different reception of the action, not so much from different individuals, but from different nationalities, which really struck us a lot. But in terms of, how we were choosing the material, that was very difficult. Because how do you actually make a uniform which we didn't want it to say, you know, custom officer, we didn't want it to say police officer, we didn't want it to say stewardess, you know, but because it was for women, it was, you know, also it could be seen very feminist, you know, so it's all these connotations which, you know, just a simple object brings with itself, you know. But just then we just kind of went really basically, you know, back to the whole idea of what a uniform is and what a uniform is supposed to be doing, and just kind of used very minimal, very basic, well, the most basic solutions we could find, and also with the voyage kits. And we actually left a lot of decision making to, for example, the factories, because we were producing all these things with Slovenian factories, because a part of the whole idea was, you know, to kind of have this, you know, kind of usage of, well, at that point, a lot of factories were closing in Slovenia. So again, to similar to Maya's video, but how to actually use a certain, a factory, but maybe it's social relations more than its other meanings, and kind of transform that, because of course, you know, Slovenia just became a service economy, you know, as soon as it entered the European Union. So a lot of factories just started producing soap and, you know, bathrobes and towels and, you know, things that could serve, you know, the tourist industry.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find out more about balkanizing taxonomy, please visit www.goldsmiths.ac.uk/balkanizing-taxonomy.